The headlines: Iran unveils its latest achievements in nuclear technology, including radiopharmaceuticals, plasma laser, and power generation programs. A Palestinian is killed and over a dozen injured in an armed confrontation with Israeli forces who raided the Jenin refugee camp. Also coming up, Pakistan's parliament is gearing up for a no-confidence vote in a motion expected to decide the fate of Prime Minister Imran Khan. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Iran marks its National Nuclear Technology Day. The capital, Tehran, has hosted a ceremony introducing the latest achievements in nuclear technology. Top officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, were in attendance. Raisi hailed the extensive research works by Iranian scientists using peaceful nuclear energy. He pledged that his government would continue to support the process. Raisi then inspected the newly unveiled nine achievements the country has made in health and agricultural sectors using nuclear technology over the past years. Those achievements include radiopharmaceuticals, plasma laser control system, and power generation programs. The Iranian president emphasized his country's right to peaceful nuclear energy. He also described as irreversible Iran's technological know-how in the nuclear field. Raisi said reliance on the youth and scientists is a model that always works and should be addressed in other areas as well. Journalist and political analyst John Bosnich says a nation's independence is measured by its ability to autonomously produce its own domestic power demands.
The power of a state is measured in many different scales, and one of those scales, the essential scale in this era, is the independence of the state in producing power for its own activities, for its own population, and for its own economic advancement. The entire world has been talking about peak oil and the end of the petroleum-powered world. Iran, as a major producer of oil and petroleum products, is facing, like other oil producers, a potential economic crisis that can only be resolved by an alternative source of energy. That source of energy at this point in time is nuclear power. I grew up in Canada, which developed the CANDU nuclear reactors. I worked as a government advisor in Japan, which is a nuclear-dependent country, despite having been the target of two nuclear attacks by the United States. Nuclear power is essential in this modern world.
Palestinians hold a funeral for a Palestinian shot dead by Israeli forces in the Jenin refugee camp north of the occupied West Bank. At least five Palestinians were also injured in the shootout. Israeli troops raided the camp and besieged the home of a young Palestinian man who was allegedly behind a shooting in Tel Aviv on Thursday night. A number of Israeli forces were injured in the ensuing firefight and were airlifted to medical centers. During the Tel Aviv shooting, at least three Israelis were killed and eight more wounded. The Israeli regime forces later killed the Palestinian shooter. Residents' resistance groups, that is, hailed the operation, saying that it was a legitimate response to Israeli crimes.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. The situation has been tense in Israel during the past days amid consecutive Palestinian operations that has left more than a dozen Israelis dead. The Palestinian operation took place in central Tel Aviv, leaving three Israelis dead and some 10 others injured. The Palestinian suspect was later killed in a confrontation with Israeli troops. Palestinian resistance groups have hailed the operation as a legitimate response to continued Israeli crimes. They also say that the operation proved Israel's fragility, as well as the ability of the Palestinian resistance to take the battle to the depths of the enemy's entity. Our first tweet of the day comes from A.Ibrahim Imsabeh. Any Palestinian reaction comes as a normal response to the Israeli ongoing crimes and violations perpetrated against Palestinians along all occupied Palestinian territories. Abbas Hamida tweeted, criminal Zionists keep playing the victim card really hard on Twitter in response to Palestinian resistance. Imagine that this is only the tip of the iceberg. How long do they think they can occupy, terrorize, and continue to play victims? They're too busy getting assurances. Samer has the next tweet. The attack on Palestinian children in their capital during the month of Ramadan and the abuse they were subjected to is inevitably matched by a response in the heart of your capital that you claim. Hashtag apartheid Israel. AKM Shaladan says it's a normal reaction from a Palestinian commando against the crimes Israeli occupation forces have done to the Palestinians every day in the West Bank. For every action, there is a reaction, as is known to everyone, and this was only our response. Hashtag Free Palestine. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians have been going on even after the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, and our next batch of comments showcases the aggressive behavior of Israeli troops towards the Palestinians in the occupied territories, with the first video being posted by Ghada Owais. She says, Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid, collective punishment against Palestinians, demolitions, administrative detention, restricting Al-Aqsa access, cruel system of domination, and the crimes against humanity committed by Israeli authorities won't bring peace. Clearly, Israel is not looking for peace. All they want is more and more Palestinian land. Rami Abdel Jabbar said, Israeli occupation forces prevented hundreds of Palestinians from the occupied West Bank from crossing into occupied Al-Quds through Qalandiyya checkpoint to perform Friday prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Many have criticized the Western double standards in dealing with the situation in Ukraine and Palestine. People say that the Western support for Ukraine against the Russian offensive and their condemnation of the Palestinian resistance against Israeli occupation is the true meaning of double standards. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by Ibrahim. Lie, then lie, and manipulate the truth so that people believe you. This is how U.S. imperialism and the colonial West deal with Palestine resistance and the war in Ukraine in their false propaganda of demonizing Russia and the Palestinian resistance. The American media is not free. I mean, what else is new? That's the job of the mainstream media, to make people believe you. Mo Money has our next tweet. Western countries don't allow Palestinian nonviolent resistance like BDS and don't allow Palestinian military resistance like in Ukraine. T-Mag has our final tweet. They said, Israel accuses Russia of war crimes in Ukraine. Ahmed Mansara, a 20-year-old Palestinian, has been systematically abused in an Israeli prison for more than 6 years and his mental health is at risk. Who should accuse Israel? Well, don't expect the West to do that anytime soon, or ever for that matter. That'll do it for another Hashtag Trending. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Security is beefed up around Pakistan's parliament as it convenes to vote on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan should stay in office. The country's top court has ordered a no-confidence vote that could lead to Khan's dismissal. The prime minister has accepted the verdict but insists that he was a victim of a regime change conspiracy involving the U.S. Pakistan embroiled into a political crisis last week after a key ally of the ruling party switched sides, prompting the opposition to issue a no-trust motion. However, Khan blocked the process and dissolved parliament. After days of hearings, the Supreme Court late on Thursday announced Khan's moves unlawful. If he loses a no-confidence vote, the opposition will choose a new prime minister. Shehbaz Sharif, the younger brother of a three-time former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, is the potential candidate to rule the South Asian country until the next polls. Ukraine is calling for harsher sanctions against Russia after a missile attack hit a train station in the eastern city of Kamchatka. The attack left 52 people dead. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the strike was a deliberate attack on civilians and a war crime. He says Kiev expects a firm global response and called for an energy embargo on Russia. Zelensky also called for all Russian banks, that is, to be cut off from the global system and demanded more weapons. He says any delay in providing arms for Ukraine would mean politicians want to help Moscow more than Kiev. The Kremlin, at the same time, has urged the West to stop supplying weapons to Kiev and blame the Ukrainian military for the attack.
Today, on April 8th, the Ukrainian military struck the railway station of Kramatorsk with a Tochka-U missile. Tochka-U missiles, which remains were found near the railway station, are used only by the Ukrainian military.
Russia's defense ministry also says the missiles were launched from a Donbass territory controlled by Ukrainian forces. The conflict is now in its 45th day. According to the UN Human Rights Office, over 1,600 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. More than 2,200 others have been injured, while another 11,000 have left their homes. The European Union is adding more than 200 individuals to its blacklist of sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. The list includes two daughters of the Russian president, as well as top businessmen, politicians, and military staff close to the Kremlin. The sanctions also target officials from Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. The restrictions include asset seizures and travel bans in the EU. The bloc has sanctioned around 700 people linked to Russia and slapped tough economic sanctions on the country since it moved on Ukraine. In response, Moscow has announced retaliatory measures against European countries. Footage has been released apparently showing Ukrainian soldiers executing a Russian prisoner of war outside a village west of the capital, Kiev. In the video, at least three men can be seen lying dead next to a fourth man who is breathing heavily with a jacket covering his head. Then a voice is heard saying he is still breathing. Afterwards, a soldier shoots the man twice in the head. The man continues to move. The soldier shoots again and he stops. The living soldiers in the video are wearing Ukrainian colors of blue and yellow on their arms, and the men on the floor are wearing white armbands, which are used by Russian troops. The video was first shared on Telegram, and some Western media outlets have verified it. The Ukrainian government has pledged an investigation. And China has warned of, quote, serious consequences of Russia's suspension from the UN Human Rights Council. It says that the move will simply fan the flames of war in Ukraine.
The drafting process of the relevant resolution was not open or transparent, nor did it follow the practice of going through consultations of all member states and heeding views extensively. This way of doing things will only aggravate the division among member states, intensify contradictions among the parties concerned, and add fuel to the fire, which is not conducive to de-escalating the conflict, still less pushing for peace negotiations. To handle the issue of membership of the Human Rights Council this way will set a new dangerous precedent, further intensifying confrontation, and induce a still bigger impact on the UN governance system with serious consequences.
Xiao Lijian also stated that China is against politicizing human rights to pressure other countries. The Chinese official cautioned against what he called a selective approach towards the issue of human rights. This after the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. China was among the 24 countries against the U.S.-initiated motion. Meanwhile, Moscow has labeled the vote illegal and politically driven. Russia stands accused of human rights violations and abuses in Ukraine, but the Kremlin denies the accusation. And Italy's nurses and healthcare workers have staged a national strike affecting hospitals across the country. Unionists are calling on the government to review the collective contract, adjusting salaries to meet changes in skyrocketing costs of living.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike, demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten.
In the midst of the pandemic, the Prime Minister himself said we won't forget about the nurses. The truth is that they have forgotten about us. We were expecting a pay raise considering the challenges and the suffering we had to go through during the pandemic. Negotiations are underway for the contractual renewal of the health sector. Let's see how it unfolds.
About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst-hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. Some people say, you must forget about the nuclear issue because it has led to so much sensitivity and has created many problems. Well, the nuclear issue is of a scientific nature. It concerns our scientific and technological progress in the future. We will shortly not find the future, be needing the products of our nuclear energy. we will completely need it. Then whom should we refer to? When must we begin the process to achieve it? Therefore, going without these things and showing negligence towards them is not correct. Another suggestion to get along with the US or any other power in order to be immune from sanctions. This means cutting off our political bargaining arm. This suggestion says that we must compromise with them because if we show a little bit toughness, they will impose sanctions on us. In my opinion, these would be grave mistakes. Of course, some people have put forward such suggestions over time with groundless, shaky, and erroneous reasoning, and they publish their opinions in newspapers and the like in the forms of theories, despite the fact that all their reasons were rejectable, and they were indeed rejected, and their insistence was of no avail.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If in the course of all these years, the people who wanted to cut off some of these arms of power were given the permission to go ahead with their ideas, the country would face grave dangers today. However, God the Exalted ordained that those individuals would not have the chance to do these things. This is one point. I mentioned that I would return to the discussion about the elements of national power. One important element of national power is the things that are directly related to the masses of the people. Things such as national unity, national self-confidence, and national hope. You who are an official in a certain organization of the country might be a self-confident person, but it might occur that you decide to do something that requires the people's help. If the people do not have self-confidence, you will not be able to pull it off.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A new book has revealed how the United States' top spying organization, the Central Intelligence Agency, carried out destabilization operations in Africa for decades. Now, the CIA not only undermined newly independent African countries, but suppressed the freedom movement in apartheid South Africa. A tip from a CIA spy to authorities in apartheid-era South Africa led to Nelson Mandela's arrest, beginning the leader's 27 years behind bars. Nelson Mandela's eldest daughter, Makeziwe, speaks here on CIA's role in the arrest of Madiba in 1962.
I am not surprised. And if we read a lot, we know of a lot of other shenanigans that the CIA has done in other countries.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on a new book which discusses how the CIA undermined newly independent African countries in operations that included assassination of leaders who were opposed to Western imperialism. In the second part of our program, we shall look at how Mauritius has taken a bold step to challenge Britain's colonial control over Chagos Islands.
CIA crimes in Africa. Historian Susan Williams has written a new book titled White Malice, the CIA and the Neocolonization of Africa. In her book, Williams uncovers secret operations pursued by the CIA from Ghana to Congo to the UN in an effort to frustrate and deny and rob Africa of nationalist leaders committed to protecting the continent's resources.
Now, this book is said to be the first comprehensive account disclosing a Western dirty war through detailed quotes from original documents and by those involved. Now, to discuss the destructive destabilization operations carried out by the CIA in Africa, we contacted Margaret Kimberley, the co-founder of Black Agenda for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our first question to you, Ms. Kimberley. Now, what is the significance of the title of the book, White Malice, in terms of the racist outlook by the CIA?
Well, I think it sums it up very well, actually. The CIA picked up where the Europeans left off as they ended in, I believe in name only in many cases, they ended their colonization of Africa. But as in other regions of the world, the U.S. picks up for them and does what they were doing, secures resources, makes sure that governments that would actually work in the interests of the people don't come to power. And if they do, to damage them and make sure that they cannot do what they intend. And it is based on race. It is racism. So I think the title White Malice is quite appropriate. It's about how racism manifests itself in foreign policy.
One of the first targets of the CIA in Africa was the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is one of Africa's most richly endowed countries in terms of mineral wealth. The CIA was deeply involved in the assassination of Congo's independence leader, Patrice Lumumba, who had vowed to protect the country's minerals from looting by Western countries. Why was the CIA obsessed with strangling the independence of African countries?
Well, they wanted to make sure they were not ever truly independent. So in the case of Congo, for example, Patrice Lumumba is the first president post-Belgian colonialism. But he talked about, for example, nationalizing that country's resources. So has, you know, Congo has everything from diamonds to copper to gold, everything the world needs. And the idea of those resources not being in the hands of the capitalist West was something they would not put up with. So that is just one example.
During the Cold War era, the United States, which claims to advocate for democracy, supported the most brutal African dictators. For instance, after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the CIA installed Mobutu Sese Seko as a president who ruled Congo with an iron fist for 32 years and even changed the name of the country to Zaire. Here is one of Mobutu's visits to Washington where he met the then U.S. President Ronald Reagan.
And I am pleased to have been able to meet again with President Mobutu, who's been a faithful friend of the United States for some 20 years. The President and I took this opportunity to review the state of U.S.-Zairean relations, and we found a large area of agreement on the major points we discussed.
After independence of African countries, the CIA continued its malicious meddling in the continent by installing puppet regimes. Now, Ms. Kimberly, how did these affect development in Africa?
Well, it meant that the leadership of the leaders of African nations did not act in the interests of their people. They acted in the interest of those outside. So in the case of Congo, that mineral wealth could have been used for the benefit of the people there. Instead, it enriched collaborators, enriched the corporations in Europe and the United States. So the goal of this meddling, in fact, was to make sure that Africa remained underdeveloped.
Now, CIA operations were not confined to plots ending in brute force. Some were cultural programs, and most African artists and scholars who received CIA sponsorship were not aware of the funding source. Peter Kaline, an expert on Cold War and decolonization, speaks here during an event discussing modernism, African literature, and the CIA. Let's take a listen.
It's not widely discussed, even among scholars of African literature, that the CIA was the most active and influential patron of Anglophone African writing during the 1960s. Through its European affiliate, the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the CIA dispersed funds to many of Africa's emerging cultural institutions, although the real source of the funding was hidden from the recipients, and that's important to keep in mind. The first major international symposium on African literature, the Conference of African Writers of English Expression at Kampala's Makerere University in 1962, was sponsored by the Congress for Cultural Freedom. The CIA supplied programming for African radio with the Transcription Center, a London-based recording studio and clearinghouse for African cultural materials. Black Orpheus, the Nigerian Arts Review, and Transition, the slick cultural magazine started in Uganda, were both supported by CIA subventions. The Mbari Club in Nigeria, the Kemkemi Arts Center in Kenya were also beneficiaries of CIA interest in African art and literature.
The CIA is currently said to be operating remote-controlled aircraft and other drones from a secret base in Niger. The covert objectives of this CIA outpost in this mineral-rich area of Africa remain unknown. There is concern that the CIA base is a hub for destabilizing the region. Is the CIA currently pursuing its malicious programs of infiltration and destabilization of Africa?
Yes, the CIA is still doing the same thing, and they work in, obviously the CIA works on behalf of the U.S., but it works very closely with European nations, such as France, for example, which still has quite a military presence in Africa. We've had, since 2008, the U.S.-Africa Command, which actually puts U.S. troops on African soil. So these are the ways in which the CIA still does its same handiwork.
U.S. meddling in Africa, and particularly the Democratic Republic of Congo, is done to pave way for looting by major multinationals. Recently, U.S. tech giants Google parent Alphabet, Apple, Dell, Microsoft, and Tesla were taken to court for use of child labor in Congo to mine cobalt, a key ingredient of batteries in electric cars and consumer electronics. A lawyer for the victims speaks here on the case.
We traced the supply chain back from the mine where the children were either killed or maimed, and have traced it back up to these companies.
Now, last question. Do you think African governments and people can thwart and resist destructive CIA activities across the continent?
It's difficult but not impossible for Africans to thwart these activities. What African countries really need are revolutionary governments. And that's obviously something that the U.S. and Europe do not want and fight against, but mass action can change things.
Thank you very much, Margaret Kimberley, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report. Now, indeed, as our guest said, if people of Africa are determined, they can resist United States meddling in the continent. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss about the recent move by Mauritius to challenge Britain's colonial control over Chagos Islands.
Challenging Britain's colonial control over Chagos.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The flag of Mauritius was recently raised for the first time on the Chagos Islands. This is an Indian Ocean archipelago that is part of Mauritius but currently illegally occupied by Britain and is also home to a United States military base. The flag was raised after Mauritius dispatched a survey ship to the Chagos Islands to press the country's claim for the strategically located and important Indian Ocean archipelago.
The Prime Minister of Mauritius said it's the first time Mauritius has embarked upon an expedition to the islands without seeking the permission of the UK. The ship was carrying the Mauritian permanent representative to the United Nations, along with scientists and a group of Chagos Islanders who were forcibly evicted by Britain half a century ago to make way for a US military base there.
Louis Olivier Bancos, who is the leader of the Chagos refugee group, speaks here after arriving in Chagos after many years.
Welcome everyone in our birthplace. This trip is so important. I've never had a media coverage who can send all my message to see how my island was before the installation of US military base. If we were white people with blue eyes, maybe we will have better treatment. We are not asking more. We are not asking less. We are asking our right as human beings. Thank you, my brothers and sisters.
Well, for more on efforts to liberate Chagos Archipelago illegally occupied by Britain, we contacted Keith Harmon-Snow, a journalist, writer, and activist. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first, what is the significance of this move by Mauritius to officially challenge Britain's colonization of Chagos Islands?
Well, Mauritius has for years now been fighting for the sovereignty of the control of these islands, which were originally under Mauritius control. And, of course, that's been denied. They've taken it through the international courts, and now there have been two favorable rulings that basically say that Britain is required to give the territory back, the archipelago, back to Mauritius. And, of course, the United States and Britain being the primary power brokers in control of the Chagos Archipelago are not going to yield to any minor player like Mauritius or even a more major player. And give up this territory.
The United Kingdom has acted in total impunity by ignoring United Nations and African Union calls for it to vacate the Chagos Islands. In 2019, the International Court of Justice backed Mauritius and said Britain should give up control of the Chagos Islands.
The United Kingdom is under an obligation to bring an end to its administration of the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible, thereby enabling Mauritius to complete the decolonization of its territory in a manner consistent with the right of peoples to self-determination.
What is the importance of Chagos Islands, and why is Britain trampling upon the international law to continue its illegal occupation of this Indian Ocean archipelago?
Well, the Chagos Archipelago is strategically located off the coast of Africa, not far from Madagascar, east coast of Africa, just south of South Asia. It's and halfway across to Indonesia and Australia. So its strategic importance can't be understated. The United States and Britain use it as a military base. Diego Garcia is the only island in the archipelago that's occupied at present.
Between 1968 and 1974, the UK forcibly evicted thousands of Chagosians from their homeland and exiled them to Mauritius and the Seychelles, where they faced extreme poverty and discrimination. The UK even handed one of the islands, Diego Garcia, over to the US, which then fully militarized it by developing a base there.
A lawyer for the indigenous inhabitants of Diego Garcia elaborates here on how they were tricked and later evicted to pave way for the illegal U.S. military base.
It was entirely improper, unethical, dictatorial to have the Chagosian put the thumbprint on an English legal drafted document, where the Chagosian, who doesn't read nor speak any English, let alone legal English, is made to renounce basically all his rights as a human being.
Back to Mr. Hammond. Now, how is the United States facilitating the continued colonization of Chagos Islands by Britain?
Well, the United States and Britain are, partners in crime all over the world. They're very close. Clearly, it's in the interests of Britain, as the base was built by the United States. Britain has complete access to it. It's joint staging ground for the both of them. So it's not like the United States is twisting anybody's arm to get Britain to support our operations there or allow the United States to continue operations there. It also should be mentioned that the Chagos Archipelago is rich in oil and gas deposits. And, clearly part of Mauritius government seeking to take control of its own territory is based around, for example, Jean-Raymond Bouel, who is one of the most powerful individuals in the world. American Mineral Fields International was one of his mining companies that operated in the Congo, very close to the Clinton family. And, they want control of the oil and natural gas, and they'll do anything to get it.
The African Union urged Britain to comply with the UN resolution and reiterated the AU's support for a complete decolonization of the Chagos Islands. In his address to the UN General Assembly, Prime Minister of Mauritius reiterated his call for Britain to stop its colonization of Chagos Islands.
Mr. President, it remains a matter of concern that more than 2 years after the International Court of Justice ruled that the decolonization process of Mauritius has not been lawfully completed in view of the unlawful accession of the Chagos Archipelago from its territory prior to independence, and that the United Kingdom has an obligation to withdraw its unlawful administration from the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible, we still see no action on the part of the colonial power. And yet, the findings of the ICJ have been affirmed by the UN General Assembly Resolution 73/295. And in January this year, a special chamber of ITLOS has held that those authoritative determinations of international law by the ICJ have binding legal effect, rendering it beyond legitimate dispute that Mauritius is sovereign over the Chagos Archipelago as an integral part of its national territory.
The people of Chagos have been relentless in fighting for decolonization of their islands and their reunification with the Republic of Mauritius. Now, most international legal channels have been exhausted, and Britain is adamant on continuing its occupation of Chagos Islands, the last remaining colony of the British Empire. Now, Mr. Hammond, our last question to you. What options remain for the people of Chagos to liberate their territory?
Well, clearly the Chagosian people have rights that have been trampled on, beginning with their forcible exile, removal back, you know, from 1966 to 1971. We're only talking about, you know, a thousand people at the time. You know, apparently their families have grown substantially. So that's, you know, it's not a large number of people, but they still have rights to this territory. Again, the United States, Britain, Israel don't care about international law. They don't care about humanitarian law. The politics of genocide are such that our governments commit crimes anytime they like, pretty much, and get away with it. And so the Chagosian people, the only real recourse that they have is to get the word out. I mean, if Americans who are opposed to the war, opposed to American military, permanent military operations, our permanent warfare economy, if the United States people and the Canadian people and the European people and Australians could stand up against the system and realize that Diego Garcia, this military base, is the most important base in the region. Shutting down that base and returning the land to the Chagosian people would be a huge, huge win for peace in the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hammond, for your insight on efforts to liberate Chagos Islands currently illegally occupied by Britain. Now, there you have it. The liberation of Chagos Islands will require international support. Well, our time is up for today. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program you will discuss issues, relevant questions and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Thank you yet again. Sheikh, last time we spoke about a narration related to the household of the Prophet about how a child, his age is split up into three categories, 0 to 7 years of age, 7 to 14, and 14 to 21. But in the grand scheme of things, are these three categorizations enough to describe this child who we like to say infinite variables and possibilities. Is it enough with only three categories?
Excellent question, brother. I would say that if you look at these age groups that have been mentioned in the hadith, they're basically guiding us towards these, you know, overall age groups. But today, where the psychology has progress to a great extent, and they themselves are categorizing children into different ages, and they have plans and strategies for different age groups.
Right.
If you look at the animation series itself, if you look at Disney, if you look at Cartoon Network, if you look at all the other, even the advertisements, if you look at them, you will see that they themselves have categorized children into different categories, and they target these content for different age groups.
Even in advertising, not only children, depending on your personality, they will market a specific product in a specific way.
Exactly. So now, limiting ourselves to these three age categories would not really help us out in solving the problem. And hence, even in the Islamic approach, we need to categorize them into more categories than just the three.
Why then do this narration only mention three categories?
Exactly. Like I said, it's the overall understanding that, look, from 0 to 7 years, it's the learning phase. So the child
right.
is learning.
Generally,
it's the learning phase. So right. the child is learning. However, what he learns from 0 to 3 years is different, and his learning curve is different.
Yeah.
And what he learns from 3 or 4 to 7 years is totally different, and the learning curve is totally different.
Sheikh, you mentioned yourself this last age category, 14 to 21, they're already married.
They're already married.
So it's a completely different age.
Exactly. And once you're married, you're at a different maturity level.
Yeah.
Therefore, In today's world, we cannot limit ourselves to these three categories and treat these three categories as one gamut or one collection and behave with them in a particular way. We need to further drill down these categories. We need to break them down as toddlers up to 3 years, so that is 0 to 3 years, then 4 to 7 years, 8 to 12 years, then 13 to 15 or 16 years, and then 17 to 19 years. And that covers up from, you know, from toddler to teenage, right? And there are already 5 or 6 categories, and each category will have a different behavior pattern, different psyche, different approach towards life, and different way of dealing with things around him. And the more precisely we understand these categories, the better we deal with them. And then from there on, you will see this other category, which is 20 to 25 years. And there's less of complications and turmoils and disturbances there. Stress levels are different there compared to someone who's in their teens. So therefore, I don't think sticking to these three major categories will suffice today, keeping in mind the psychological progress that's happening. I think we need to break down these categories to a further extent.
And on that note, dear Sheikh, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing the effectivity of only categorizing children in three age groups according to this narration from the household of the Prophet. Dear Sheikh, before we went on a break, you quite eloquently said that no, it is not enough, that even as far as people aged 21 and 23 and 24 years of age, they are also categorized in a specific category. Great. But Sheikh, we have this narration now in our hands. Does this mean that this narration is outdated?
Again, like I mentioned, it's not about the narration being outdated. The narration is telling us something that's a generic and overall behavior. So, like I mentioned in the earlier part, 0 to 7 years, there's a different kind of learning happening. The risk factor is less. 7 to 14 years, there's a different kind of learning happening. Right. And the risk factor is really, really high. And from all that learning that has happened, 14 to 21 years is a different kind of a learning with a different approach of risk factor. Let me mention this concept called situational leadership, if you've heard of it.
Please do.
Situational leadership by Ken Blanchard. If you see the situational leadership, you will see that it has 4 blocks in it. It's called D1, D2, D3, D4. And it has a management pattern of S1, S2, S3, and S4. These 4 categories are clearly defined, that whoever is at S1 level, they are full of energy. They want to do so many things, but they have the least experience. And therefore, they end up doing more mistakes and more flaws in their performance compared to someone who's at D4 level. Why? Right. Because they have experience with them. So can I behave with this S1 the way I behave with the D1? I cannot. Why? Because he is a newbie. He doesn't know anything, but he wants to do everything. You tell him you need to move a mountain, he'll say, yes, I'll move a mountain. But here there's learning happening with lack of experience. So the way you deal with this person is different compared to someone who's already got 5 years of experience, right? So in the work environment, when you see this, this is exactly what the tradition is also telling you. Look, there are 3 categories, and each category is further divided into subcategories. Let me give you an example of children's books, right? If you look at the story books or the bedtime stories and stuff like that, you will see that the books that are designed for children who are less than 3 years, there are more pictures in it and less
words,
text in it.
More color.
More color, bright colors, attractive, big picture. So if they want to draw a teddy bear, the teddy bear covers the whole page. It's not one little teddy bear which is one-tenth of the page. No, it covers the whole page. Why? Because the eyesight is at a certain level. They can't see small things. They need to see big things.
Right. Attention.
Exactly. Attention span and all that.
Right.
Now, the same child, the moment he reaches 4 years, you show him that book. He says, I'm bored of this book. This is not interesting for me anymore. You need to give me something else. What do you want? More pictures with more animals in it, variety of animals, and more words in it. Why? Because now the learning curve is different. The same child, when he crosses 7 years, he would pay less attention to pictures and more attention to increasing the vocabulary, right?
Right.
So, again, this overall generic understanding that the tradition has given us is that, look, here's the learning happening and here's the risk factor and this is how you...